Spectator and our wonderful sponsors that make these debates possible, Brew and Dolphin, let me welcome you all here tonight. So good to see so many of you. Clearly not much on television tonight. But then, of course, it's not Thursday, is it? So that's why we can see you're all here. The motion before us tonight is Iraq and Syria are lost causes. Western intervention can't help. And we've got a distinguished panel of speakers, three on each side. We're also, for the first time, because the Twitter arm of the Spectator just gets bigger and bigger, we've now got a new Twitter section. So anybody who wants to tweet while the debate's going on, please feel free to do so. I think the signal's quite strong. Oh, yes. Good old Church of England up with the times. And you can read that using hashtag SpecDebate or the tag at SpectatorEvent. So that's hashtag SpecDebate, capital S and capital D, though I'm not sure it's case sensitive. And the tag is at Spectator Events, capital E at Spectator. And I will read out some, if there are any that are interesting and polite to our speakers. And we'll retweet as well, and a bit of a debate can get going in the, as Gordon Brown called it, the web sphere, as well as taking place in reality here in our debating chamber. Each speaker will speak for 9 minutes, uninterrupted by either you or by the other members of the panel. At 8 minutes, I will just do a little, just to let them know they're running out of time. I'll be quite brutal on the 9 minutes, simply for fairness of play. After we've heard the major speeches, which will take place from the lectern of our six debaters up here, we will read out how you voted on the way in tonight. Because in a sense, there are two ways to win tonight. You can win the motion, most votes for or against, but also you can win if you, and in a sense, this is the winner of the debate as opposed to the motion, if you get a shift of opinion inside this hall from one side to the other because of the quality and power of the arguments. And once I've done that, we'll then throw it open to the audience. I'll take points. No speeches. We've had enough speeches after we've heard these six. And we'll get a debate going between the platform up here and the floor. So I think that's the logistics of this evening. We'll aim to stick to time as well. So, to begin, the motion again. Iraq and Syria are lost causes. Western intervention cannot help. Please welcome an award-winning French Algerian journalist who specialises in the Middle East, North Africa and Islamic affairs. Nabila Ramdani.
Good evening, and thank you very much indeed, Andrew. We're in very distinguished military company tonight, so I'd like to start with one of the oldest adages in the history of combat, and that is, know your enemy. What was very clear about Western foreign policy vis-à-vis Iraq and Syria for many years is that it was always very vague about who the enemy was. This has been a consistent tenet of Western foreign policy towards the region in which Iraq and Syria are located for decades. Dictators are backed and then deposed along with their expendable regimes. Meddling and muddling by the British, the French, and more recently the Americans is arguably the principal reason for instability in the region, and there is no doubt whatsoever that it has caused cataclysmic loss of life, not least of all in Iraq, over the past decade plus. And it is only now that a group of nihilistic killers wearing black and waving sinister banners has appeared that some express confidence that the Western military machine can go in and annihilate them. It is my contention that it cannot, and that Western military intervention will cause far more problems than it is designed to solve. I'd like to make it clear from the start that it is an entirely pragmatic argument. I am by no means arguing that Syria and Iraq are lost causes per se. What I am arguing is that the long-term solution to the region's endemic problems must come from within, and that Western intervention is a lost cause. In practical terms, this means that indigenous communities must deal with their own problems and not allow often bemused, muddled, inconsistent USA to go in and shoot everybody up while offering zero long-term strategy for progress. We only have to look at the absolute disaster of the American-led invasion of 2003 and the comparable disaster of Nathan's Afghan adventure to see where intervention leads us. With due respect to other coalition partners, it is undoubtedly America leading the current limited intervention against IS and providing the vast majority of firepower. And once again, they are getting it all wrong. President Obama scandalously muddled policy was clear for all to see when he last year threatened Syria's Bashar al-Assad with airstrikes if he crossed the red line by using chemical weapons against his own people. Well, Assad did cross that red line, many times in fact, and murdered thousands of the most vile manner possible, and Obama did nothing. Now Obama has faced up to the realization that he needs Assad, along with other ideological enemies, including Iran, to destroy IS. And I know I haven't got anything like enough time to go into the complex diplomacy involved, but not knowing your enemy is again defining Western intervention. And there is certainly a great deal of ignorance about what IS is. What it isn't is an organized military force which can be destroyed by aerial bombardment. It works primarily within civilian communities, clearly using them as human shields whenever necessary. It has no conventional military objectives beyond creating a fantasy land, global caliphate, completely at odds with the modern world. It is an exclusively negative organization based on resentment of the West. Just look at the way IS recruits from foreign countries, including Britain and France. Jihadists don't tend to travel to fight in Syria and Iraq because they have great ambitions for themselves or for their families or anything else. They go because they despise the West. And in this sense, IS is a direct result of the muddled, cynical, and destructive intervention of the West in Iraq. Evil thrives on a sense of resentment, and any of us who has spent time in the region under discussion can assure everybody here tonight that resentment is indeed widespread, just as it is in other recent theatres of war involving Western powers from Afghanistan to Libya. Carry on bombing the civilian community surrounding IS. Carry on destroying infrastructure and essential services. Carry on with misguided, ill-thought-out wars, which are perceived by many Muslims as wars on Islam, and the death and destruction will go on and on. IS knows this. It's the reason it beheads people and posts the images on the internet. It's the reason it baits men like Obama and David Cameron with blood-curdling threats. It's the reason it recruits frustrated, angry, anti-Western young men looking to kill and maim. IS's highly effective campaign could have been choreographed in Hollywood. And the really terrifying bit is that it is working exactly as planned. IS is made up of maximum 20,000 fighters, but there is no prospect of the West destroying it from the air. The West has been bombing Iraq for decades, killing and destroying with impunity. Instead, IS wants to draw the West into a permanent state of war in which Iraq and Syria remain the principal battlegrounds. The country's populations will become more battle-hardened, more resentful, and inevitably more radicalized. Continuing to attack Iraq and starting a war in Syria will further lead to exactly that amongst Iraqis and Syrians and Muslims across the world. Oil is a word which comes up time and time again when critics of the West examine the motives for waging war in the region. Countries which have been decimated by savage wars are inevitable breeding grounds for groups like IS, and this is particularly so in countries in which the West has intervened in recent years. Western bombing of Iraq is already claiming civilian lives, while its military effectiveness is so far negligible. There will be calls for escalation, up to and including putting soldiers on the ground. Again, we have very little time tonight to outline ambitious regional alliances or indeed effective local strategies for defeating IS and putting Iraq and Syria on the road to peace and stability. But in summary, my pragmatic short-term view is that Assad, Syria, and Iran can provide the ground forces to defeat IS, Both have well-equipped armies and indeed air forces which are more than capable of doing the job. The Turks are also a formidable military force. Their involvement will hasten the defeat of IS. John Kerry is on the record as saying he wants to de-conflict with Assad. Despite his proven reputation as a monstrous dictator, Assad is the key to defeating IS, along with Iran, which regards the Sunni IS as a mortal threat to Shia governments in Tehran, Damascus, and Baghdad. An anti-jihadi alliance involving perceived devils is not ideal, but nor is the way in which the West has forged security links with countries like Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, the United Arab Emirates, and Qatar. For decades, these countries' leaders have provided hundreds of millions of dollars in cash and arms to the very terrorists threatening the West across the globe. The key to long-term peace and stability in the region is for local people to destroy IS with the backing of Arab and Muslim allies in the region. The lead should come from within the region and should include a long-term political vision. Given security and a fairer deal, Iraqi and Syrian Sunnis can eject IS with the help of the Iranians. In the current turmoil, the West at least knows exactly who its main enemy is. It should also wake up to who is best qualified to defeat that enemy. Thank you very much.
Nabila Ramdani. And now let's have our first speaker tonight against the motion. He concluded his military career as Chief of the General Staff of the British Army. He's now a member of the House of Lords. Please welcome General Dannatt.
Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, good evening. And can I say, first of all, what a great pleasure it is to be taking part in this spectator debate. Even if it's a motion, Iraq and Syria are lost causes, Western intervention can't help, a motion that I just fundamentally disagree with. But it's still nevertheless a great pleasure to be taking part. And Andrew, thank you very much for chairing this. Of course, we know that Iraq and Syria are ancient civilizations. I think they're ancient civilizations that, given a different run of history, it would be much better if there had been no question of Western intervention becoming part of the argument and part of the discussion tonight. But of course, that defies history, that defies more recent history. Syria and Iraq themselves are constructs, are part of decision making in the early part of the 20th century, which created the modern state of Syria and which created the modern state of Iraq. I've often been asked in time past, you know, why was it that we felt a need, whatever the arguments were, to go into Iraq in 2003? Surely nothing to do with us. I mean, you can debate the merits of that, and I don't want to go one way or another on that. But it's very difficult for a country like the United Kingdom to walk away from a country like Iraq when we had a fundamental hand in constructing that modern country. We can't just say it's someone else's problem and be like Denmark or Switzerland and put our heads in the sand. We actually, whether we like it or not, are hardwired into the construct of that part of the world and therefore have a hand in its destiny. I mean, the contention behind this motion is that Iraq is now so weakened, popularly said as a result of the intervention in 2003. That might to an extent be true. It's certainly the intervention in 2003 was significantly responsible for destabilizing the region. Certainly, at least the balance between Iraq and Iran, and that's a fundamental issue that history will have to take note of. But then, of course, the government that we left behind in Iraq was thought initially, when Maliki became the prime minister, that this would be a reasonable government. He didn't come from one of the particular power bases, and that was thought to be a merit in its own right. But we discovered subsequently, of course, that that's not the case. Extraordinarily pro-Shia in the decisions that he took, a fundamental factor behind the disenfranchisement and the disaffection by the Sunni population, which ISIL has been able to exploit so spectacularly in the last two or three years, a great shame in many ways that the Americans felt they couldn't stay and exert some influence in Iraq after 2011. The issue of jurisdiction of their troops became so important to them that they abrogated their responsibilities and went, with the consequences for the future governance of Iraq that we've now seen. And then Syria, swept up in the aftermath of the so-called Arab Spring, when perfectly reasonably a number of the countries that Western countries had a hand in putting in place some 40 years ago, the people we supported wanted to have a greater hand in the governance of their own countries. That's not entirely unreasonable. But then focused on to Syria and Assad, very quickly Western governments decided, and I'm not making the alternative case here, but Western governments decided very quickly that Assad was not to be supported, that Assad should go, we would recognise the opposition forces, and that his regime was illegitimate. Well, it can be argued, and I only say it can be argued, that maybe he was amongst those, and his close colleagues were amongst those, who most understood the complex nature of that ancient society that was Syria. But the West said he had to go. He was determined not to go. The consequence of that has been a brutal civil war. So we have Syria caught in civil war. We have Iraq caught up in the consequences of our intervention, and then a very factional pro-Shia government under Maliki after that. With the consequence that we've seen now in June, July this year, with ISIL suddenly bursting onto the scene. Actually, of course, they hadn't been bursting onto the scene. They had been there in Syria for quite some time. They had formed part of the opposition forces fighting the Assad regime. If you think a year, 18 months ago, there was quite a lot of discussion about should we be arming the opposition in Syria. But mercifully, we didn't. Of course, if we had, a fair number of the weapons and equipment and training that we might have offered the opposition in Syria would probably have gone to what we now know as ISIL, and we'd actually have been fanning the same flames that we're actually now trying to put out. And ISIL fighters had honed their skills, if you like, fighting against Assad's regime, and the Syrian army, the Syrian armed forces, which are pretty competent, Russian-trained, Russian-backed over many years. Nothing wrong with that. That's their sphere of influence. But ISIL had cut their teeth, if you like, against the Assad regime, and then burst into northern Iraq in June, July this year with spectacular success and proclaimed the Islamic State. So what to do? We've got Iraq and Syria in this motion described as lost causes. But can we actually really accept the notion of countries of such history and importance in that region being lost causes? Of course we can't. They are ancient civilizations of great significance. They're countries of great significance. They're countries actually potentially both of great wealth. They must not be allowed to be lost causes. Of course, the West has wanted to intervene, but has been caught on the horns of the dilemma between doing what you might describe as the right thing or the popular thing. And if there was a big lesson that was learnt and taken away, certainly in the popular mind, of our interventions in Iraq and Afghanistan over the last 10, 12 years or so since 9/11, it was that there is a huge risk in putting our Judeo-Christian boots on Islamic soil. And even if we've gone to places like Iraq and Afghanistan previously with the best of intentions of being part of the solution, our mere presence gets turned around and we become part of the problem. So I can see the case, I can see the argument why there is every effort being made not to get the West unduly involved in Iraq and Syria. But can we leave them as lost causes? No, we can't leave them as lost causes. The British Parliament debated these issues in a very narrow sense in 2013, in August last year, on the very narrow contention of Assad's regime apparently having used chemical weapons and crossed Obama's red line, and therefore something should be done. David Cameron was very keen that something should be done. But he didn't really listen to the mood of the country. He didn't listen to the mood of the Parliament. I don't think he listened to the mood of his whips. And he lost that debate. He lost that vote. And that was mistranslated as the fact that Britain had lost its will to fight, that the West had probably lost its will to fight. But on the narrow issue of bombing against Assad's chemical capability, at a time when it was unproven that it had necessarily been the centre of the regime that had authorised those attacks, in that very complex Syrian civil war, probably our intervention in that manner at that time would probably have made the situation worse. So it was right that we didn't intervene in that manner, bombing against the chemical capability. But the lesson was so strong that we have stood back and not chosen to intervene at all. And the problem in Syria has got worse. And we saw what we saw, and I just described in June, July this year, ISIL bursting into our consciousness. There's awful executions, there's awful murders taking place. And we realise that we have got a major problem on our hands. And can we just leave that problem? Of course we can't leave that problem. The strategic objective is to destroy Islamic State and destroy ISIL. And on the way to destroying it, it's got to be discredited. And I think it's really important that they are discredited, because the alternative narrative that young Muslim people in this country have got to understand is that actually they are very welcome, they are part of our society here, their future must be in this country, they should have their own stakes, their own future in our society here in Britain and in the West, and not feel they've got to be attracted to go to some jihad on some apparently exciting Islamic State mission. That's why Islamic State has got to be discredited on its way to being destroyed. Intervention from the air is not going to destroy Islamic State. From the air, we can only change the terms of engagement. This will have to be settled on the ground. On the ground, currently, are elements of the Free Syrian Army, are elements of the Peshmerga. When we put some more backbone into the Iraqi army, they as well. Will that be enough? It won't be. It is my concern that when eventually an offensive operation has got to be mounted, it will actually require Western support. And it may, I don't want to see it, it may require Western intervention. So Iraq and Syria are not lost causes. Western intervention may have to be the last resort. Thank you.
General Dannett. Now we come to our second speaker for the motion tonight, leading Conservative backbencher, MP for Wokingham. Please welcome John Redwood.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, it is my pleasant task today to argue that you cannot bomb ideology and religion out of people. It is my simple task tonight to convince you that Iraq and Syria do not lack weapons of war or vengeance. They don't lack bombs and bullets. They don't lack aerial bombardment. They don't lack fighting people. What these once great countries lack is political leadership. What they lack is advice on how to win back their peoples to civil and civilian government. What they lack is the process of politics and diplomacy. Now, I know in our country, politics and diplomacy are often derided or looked down upon, but they are an awful lot better than war. And war, ladies and gentlemen, insurrection, violence, terrorism, is what you get when politics and diplomacy fail. They're what you get when tyrants rule, or when so-called democratic governments rule, but they do not understand the first thing about a democracy. A democracy has to respect the minorities as well as the majority. It's not winner takes all. Its winner governs in accordance with what is politically acceptable, understanding that the minorities have rights as well as the majority. And these great countries may have a great future. That will be determined entirely by whether political leadership emerges in these countries that can get Sunni to lay down arms against Shia, that can get Kurd to be governed alongside Iraqi and Syrian people. And if those people emerge, and I wish them well, I want my country and the mighty West to give them every kind of decent support they will require to do it. It is not my task tonight to say that definitely Iraq and Syria are lost causes. I take the second part of the sentence to govern the first part. It is Western military intervention cannot bring about great democracies in Iraq and Syria. We fought two wars in Iraq in recent years. If military intervention was the right answer, why isn't it now a great democracy? And I'm very pleased that the general showed the muddle of the British establishment in his remarks this evening, because the military establishment was urging us to go and topple Assad last year. Something had to be done, they said. Now, I and the 100 Conservative MPs who told the Prime Minister before the summer recess that we would in no way support military intervention in Syria did not do so out of any love for Assad, a loathsome regime that's been killing its own citizens in a way that we find as appalling as anyone else. But why we said we had no wish to support military intervention in Syria was we could not see forces of opposition strong enough and democratic enough who could emerge and settle a civilian government in reasonable time if our force helped topple Assad. And just look what happened in Libya. In Libya, the West showed that it was quite easy to topple a nasty dictator. I had no more love of Gaddafi than David Cameron. But what has happened now, ladies and gentlemen? There is a so-called democratic government cowering in the east of the country, short of money even to hire the boat where they stay, because they cannot go into their capital city and they cannot set forth in most parts of their country. It is now fought over by warring bands. And those people who did not like Gaddafi and had to live under him did realize there was something worse than living under Gaddafi, because at least under Gaddafi, if they had no political views or expressed support for the leader when asked, they could go to work, they could earn an income, they could go home to their families at night. Now, many of them cannot even do that, because those warring bands are blowing up their house or evicting them from their flat or destroying their place of work so they can no longer do what you and I take for granted and go about our daily business and have a reasonable lifestyle. And if we're going to help these countries break out of this dismal cycle of poverty and violence and insurrection and spite, we have to show there is hope for the future. And that hope has to be based on peace and on discussion and negotiation and talking. It has to be based on restoring economic activity and social conversation in countries that are now just the subject of warring bands. Not easy. I have no easy remedy. But what I do know is that killing more people is not going to be the answer. I'm very glad that the United States and the United Kingdom, our country, has made it clear that we will not be expecting our young soldiers to go in and fight the war on the ground against ISIL. It's asking too much. These 20-year-olds, they don't know any of the local languages. They don't know the local religions or customs. They are being asked to operate under orders of great restraint. They're meant to kill the terrorists, but not the civilian people. But how do they know who is a terrorist and who is a nice civilian under the influence of the terrorist? They're not fighting a normal army in uniforms where the target can be identified and they can be given clear orders to close. And even the young officers who have access to people who can help them translate are expected to make incredibly difficult judgments. Get it wrong, and they could be up on a war crime charge. And they get it wrong, not shoot someone who is about to shoot one of their soldiers, and they let down their own troops. We're asking too much of them. This has to be done by local forces and preferably by local people who at some point realize it is better to talk than to shoot. I learnt a lot from the Northern Ireland tragedy in our country. And what I learnt from that tragedy was when both John Major and Tony Blair had the courage to say, you may be terrorists, you may have blown people up, but the only way forward is to talk to you. I think they were right. I think they were both brave. They both faced parties that weren't entirely persuaded. But it's an awful lot better now in Northern Ireland because people talk to each other instead of automatically resorting to violence. And how would we have liked it if Americans had brought violence into Northern Ireland in a helpful spirit on one side or the other? When I ask for those who would wish to intervene whether they are Sunni or Shia, they don't know. Some days of the week they're pro-Sunni, some days of the week they're pro-Shia. When I ask them whether they want an independent Kurdish state or not, they normally tell me they don't, yet they want to arm the Kurds and make them the most effective fighting force in the area. So why should the Kurds give up if they defeat ISIS? Why wouldn't they then want an independent Kurdistan? Aren't we now creating exactly the conditions to break up these two countries, which we say we are trying to protect and create as a whole? Maybe it does need to be more than two countries. I am not local. I do not know the local languages and customs. I cannot judge. That is for local politicians to decide. But it may be that the lines drawn on the map, mainly by the Western powers 100 years ago, are no longer the right lines. That is the kind of thing that local politics has to settle. We've just shown the world, in our country, the way you get to the point where a significant minority in a part of your country thinks it no longer wishes to be governed by that country. You need to have a strong democratic argument and settle it by a vote. And then those who win have to understand that they've only partially won, and that the process continues of having to woo people over and persuade them that they have enough self-government to live within your state. We should be proud of our achievements so far in this difficult Scottish debate. And we should say to people in Iraq and Syria and in the Kurdish lands and on the borders of Turkey that there are diplomatic and political and democratic ways of sorting out these issues. And it's about endless conversation. It's about very tough argument, very strong, passionate argument. And it's about trying to find a basis on which people can conclude these matters by voting and talking rather than by shooting and bombing. That surely is the message of the West. That is the democracy we should be exporting. We will never export democracy at the end of a gun and from 20,000 feet in the air dropping a bomb. We don't know always who we're killing. They move around even when our intelligence is very good, and sometimes our intelligence isn't very good. We then have the guilt on our conscience that we've killed innocent civilians in Iraq or in Syria or in Libya when we thought we were meant to be doing good. Ladies and gentlemen, I could not cast my vote to go to war in Syria. I could not cast my vote this time to go to war in Iraq. I deeply regret that I made the mistake of voting for Blair's war, having failed to get the leader of the opposition to back my view that we should have opposed it. I have learnt my lesson. I just hope the rest of the British establishment have now learnt theirs. Let's be bold and strong for diplomacy and for democracy. Let's tell them that talking works and bombing doesn't.
John Redwood.
Our second speaker against the motion tonight is a senior fellow for Middle Eastern Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Please welcome Ed Hussein.
Thank you very much, Andrew, and thank you to all of you. I'm probably the only person on the panel who actually has lived in Syria and lived in Syria during the so-called Iraq War between 2003 and 2005. Mm-hmm. And I continued to visit Syria up until 2010, just before the Arab uprisings. Last month, I was in Gaziantep in Turkey on the border with Syria. And I was also in the Za'atari refugee camp, the largest refugee camp for Syrians, 100,000 plus in Jordan, and also the Azraq refugee camp. Now, 6 months ago, I would be on the other side of the debate, and I would agree in total with what John Redwood and some of what Nabila had said. But something happened, and that something changes everything, and those arguments from last year are no longer valid today, and that is ISIS. ISIS changes the entire calculation in relation to whether we get involved militarily, diplomatically, and in other ways in the Middle East or not. Nobody predicted the rise of ISIS. I was based for the last 4 years in the United States, both in Washington and New York, and for the whole host of geopolitical analysis, nobody predicted the rise of a caliphate in the heart of the Middle East. Yes, we predicted the rise of Islamist fighters, but that landmass larger than England, controlled by a group of people who are no more than ideologically 200 in the caves in Afghanistan in 2001 to now in excess of 20,000. That changes everything, and I'll explain to you why. And I say to you that we've been here before. We've been here before in 1818. Anybody want to guess what happened in 1818? The first Saudi state was created. A group of people, much like ISIS, exact literal adherence to hadith literature, born in Najd, went around ravaging around the Najd and occupied what was then Riyadh. That force in 1824 emerged as a second Saudi state, fighting between the Al-Rashid tribe with the Saud tribe, who was then backed by the Al-Sheikh tribe, the Wahhabi tribe. It was destroyed by the Egyptians with the protection of the Ottoman Empire. They went in militarily and they destroyed it. In 1902, again, this ISIS precursor, the Saudi state, re-emerges. It retakes Riyadh again. This time in 1902, the Ottomans and the Egyptians are much weaker. They're under British control, especially in Egypt. 1916, the First World War is in full flow, and the British support the Saudi regime or the Wahhabi forces, and they're battling against the Al-Rashid tribe and the rise of the Al-Saud tribe in order to break away the Ottoman Empire with a particular focus on creating what was then the Arab Revolt to minimize the Ottoman Turks against whom we were fighting at the time. 1924, the Wahhabis, the precursors of ISIS, take Mecca and Medina. They annex what was then called Hijaz in Mecca and Medina with Najd, and by 1932 they declare the Saudi Arabian state or the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. That history and that consequence leads to where we are today. What I spoke about now are two factors that we don't understand here in the modern West, especially here in Europe, and that's religion and tribes. John Redwood rightly spoke about local customs, local languages, but local tribes also matter. And this interplay between the Al-Saud, or the House of Saud, this interplay with the Al-Rashid tribe, who they overthrew, this support from the Wahhabi Al-Sheikh tribe that is today the de facto religion in Saudi Arabia, and that outward influence is what has led us today to fighting ISIS. This is not a new war. This is not a new ideology. This is not a new fight. This has been in our midst for at least 150 years. Now, Iraq and Syria are not lost causes. And if we think they are lost causes, we don't understand the mindset of our enemy. Nabila Ramadani said, "Know your enemy." To our enemy, to ISIS, to Wahhabis, however you want to phrase them, to Al-Qaeda, to Ahrar al-Sham, to Liwa al-Tawheed, whatever name you want to give the extremists who are fighting, for them, Syria is the home of the Umayyad Caliphate that lasted from 661 to 750. Iraq is the home of the Abbasid Caliphate that lasted from 750 to 1517. And they are on the borders of the Ottoman Caliphate that lasted from 1453 to 1924. To them, all of this history is not abstract, is not something that's in the history books. It's alive. They talk about this in their publications. They warn about the fact that they are not only going to be uniting Iraq and Syria and obliterating the Shia populations in those countries, but they talk about marching on Jerusalem because they are motivated by the hadith literature that predicts an end-time apocalyptic war between the forces of good and the forces of evil. This religious sectarian war by ISIS and others is being framed very much along those lines. Now, when they talk about an end-time war, they speak about Jerusalem, they speak about Rome, they speak about Mecca, they speak about Medina. Just as 2 years ago, we did not see the rise of a caliphate, I put it to you, if there was a march by ISIS and its tens of thousands of people on Mecca, on Medina, on Saudi Arabia, and if we took the attitude that there will be no Western intervention, how many Saudi fighters do you think will be prepared to fight ISIS? Because they recognize ISIS as one of them. ISIS shares the Wahhabi ideology of takfir, the Wahhabi ideology of al-wala wal-bara, shares the Saudi Wahhabi outlook of disassociating from the Shia Muslims, believes in the tatbiq al-sharia or the imposing of literalist sharia. These are all Saudi Wahhabi teachings that have gone global. Global because we've turned a blind eye to the Middle East, we've cut deals with Saudi dictatorships and monarchs, and now we're about to do the same thing with ISIS. What we will get if we turn a blind eye to smashing ISIS is Saudi Arabia and Wahhabism on steroids globally. And what that means is 9/11, or whether it's a sectarianism in Iraq, or whether it's the sectarianism that's been unleashed in Afghanistan and in Pakistan, or whether it's the suicide bombings doing the rounds globally, or whether it's the 7/7 that struck us here in London and in Madrid, or whether it's 30 million Muslims who live in our midst here in the West, exposed increasingly to a loyalty to the so-called caliph that cites Quran and Hadith to them, as opposed to the monarch of this land. That's what we're up against. Iraq and Syria are no longer over there, but they're in our midst. And if we vote against trying to stop greater intervention in the Middle East, especially in this current conflict, we are not voting for a mere academic abstract debate. What ISIS, interestingly, in Dabiq magazine, the most recent publication, called analysis paralysis, you know, we shouldn't be falling into their trap, because they know our mindset that we can be weak, and we overanalyze, overthink these matters rather than commit to the action of striking the enemy where it hurts. I want to conclude by saying two things, and that is what needs to happen rather than what we're prepared to do. What we're prepared to do is debate and discuss this at 30,000 feet level, and our American friends are considering drones and the like, but what's needed on the ground, for what I'm seeing in the refugee camps and the discussions I hear from Syrian friends who come and visit, the country I knew, the country I lived in, is that we need troops on the ground to divide fighting faction from tribe to area, to create humanitarian corridors. Without troops on the ground, there is no point in us bombing from 30,000 feet and hoping that the work will be done on the ground. It won't be done. I argued personally for Turks and Egyptians and Saudis and Jordanians to intervene for the last 2.5 years in the United States. Today, we can say that there is no appetite among the Jordanians or the Syrians or the Syrian army or the others to intervene for a whole host of reasons. You know, ISIS's analysis of analysis paralysis is affecting the Turks, who are now having to balance up the Kurdish question and much more. So for all of our reliance on our local allies, without Western leadership, it will not happen. And without Western leadership, we will let ISIS off the hook, and we will have the kind of Saudi Arabia, without the House of Saud, the kind of Saudi Arabia in its puritanical Wahhabism, appealing to Muslims and others globally in our midst and unleashing the kind of extremist terrorist violence that we've seen visit us. My final point is this, that this is only a symptom of a much larger regional problem. ISIS did not emerge in a vacuum. Saudi Arabia doesn't maintain itself in a vacuum. The dictatorships now in Egypt and elsewhere do not get our support in a vacuum. There's something deeper going on here. There's a wounded sense of Arab pride that's in the mix, and a desire for Arabs and Muslims in the region to see some form of unification. Now, when I say unification, I take you back to where we were here in Europe in the 1930s. Don't forget, we too have a history of intolerance towards religious minorities. Think the Holocaust, think 6 million people being killed. We too have a history of fascism and of Nazism and dictatorships and contested borders. We've been there. We know what it's like. When we are now where we are, despite the Little Englander mindset and despite the rhetoric to do away with the European Union, and yes, the European Union is to blame for much, but at least there is no longer the fighting that was unleashed on this continent from the Reformation onwards. Now, that history of the European Union, of the United States of America being political unions, is of huge relevance to the modern Middle East, in that they too want to see a Middle East that's a federation, that has a rotating presidency, that has religious pluralism, that has, yes, capitalism and free market economies. And that call has come from a whole host of people, not least the Turks, the Jordanians, others. And I say this last point as I finish. If we do not have this long-term view towards the region of a greater federated, integrated region, look at our enemies. ISIS, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, ACAB, Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghrib, they think in regional terms. We too must defeat them at their game and put our allies, who are broadly thus far religious but secular Muslims, at the helm, rather than be controlled by the likes of ISIS and others in years to come. Thank you very much for listening.
Ed Hussein. Our third speaker for the motion tonight is a distinguished journalist, now a correspondent of The Independent, author of The Jihadi's Return, ISIS and the New Sunni Uprising. He told me he had been in Baghdad earlier this summer. Please welcome Patrick Coburn.
Thank you very much. I wonder if the phrasing of the motion, instead of saying Iraq and Syria are lost causes, Western intervention can't help, if it said Iraq and Syria are complex, sectarian civil wars, would which we're contemplating getting involved in, as we did in Iraq in the past. I wonder if that would change the minds of some people who quite understandably see the ritual murders by the Islamic State. They see people having barrel bombs dropped on them by the Syrian government. They see all these atrocities and feel we should do something. But that's not enough. One has to think, what should we do? And how should we do it? And when it comes to the Islamic State, one point, and I'll return to it later, ISIS, the Islamic State, is the child of war. It flourishes in war. The leadership are the people who've been fighting the Americans, the Iraqi government, murdering people since 2003, fighting in Iraq, and were re-energized by the war in Syria starting in 2011. To see the solution to the existence of the Islamic State as being purely military, I think, is to misunderstand the problem. But in concrete terms also, we have to think, who are we supporting? And that was not really what was thought about in 2003. We'd be supporting the Iraqi government. What is this government? It has an army. It had an army earlier this year, 350,000 men. It had 60,000 men in Mosul. It was attacked by 1,300 members of the Islamic State, and the Iraqi army fled. Why did it flee? Well, basically, because there weren't 60,000 there, there were probably about 20,000, because the Iraqi army, all officers pay for their positions. You don't become an officer in the Iraqi army without paying for it. Why do you pay for it? Because you want to make money. How do you do that? Well, every checkpoint, you drive around Iraqi checkpoints in Baghdad, if you're driving a truck, it's going to be $100. The checkpoints act as mini customs posts. Why were there so few troops in Mosul? Well, because a large chunk of the Iraqi army are ghost battalions. The officers pocket their money, they don't exist. Others join the army, get their salary, they kick back half to the officers. I mean, the last time I checked, it cost about $200,000 to get the position of a colonel, about $2 million to be a divisional commander. I'm making these points because they're practical points. If you're serious about an intervention, you have to know who you're intervening in favor of. So that's why the Islamic State is now on three sides of Baghdad. But we mustn't be in the position, as we were in 2003, of sort of fantasizing about who we're supporting. Who does the Baghdad government depend on at the moment? Actually, it depends on Shia militias. There were four in June. Now there are about 20 or 30. They're on all the roads around Baghdad, partly criminalized, very dangerous, very sectarian. Sunni coming in to the city, often picked up, held for ransom, tens of thousands of dollars. The money often paid. Usually the person picked up is murdered. In other words, it's a sectarian government. And if you plug in to supporting this government, then you plug in to supporting a sectarian agenda. This is sort of what happened to the Americans after 2003. In Iraq, in Syria, what's our practical policy? It has been the American policy and the British policy has been that we're somehow going to support Syrian moderates. And we're going to build them up, and they're going to fight the Islamic State and the Assad government. The problem is that nobody can find these moderates on the ground. And my colleagues, why do journalists find it so difficult to go there? Even when you go with the most moderate group, there is a good chance that they'll either sell you to the jihadis, as happened to my poor colleagues who've been ritually murdered, or they will hold you themselves for ransom. And these are the most moderate people one can find. Journalists aren't stupid. So those are the sort of people who we say we're going to support.
And there's no other way that intervention will really work. You want to talk about intervention in general terms. It would be nice to do something really nasty to the Islamic State. It would be nice to weaken these people. But one has to think of this in practical terms of how this will really be done. The answer is that it can't be even weakened solely by military means. I mean, somebody made the point that you can't at Kobani, where they've concentrated, but elsewhere, there have been 969 airstrikes. This was up to just before Kobani, about the 10th of October. Only 90 of these actually led to airstrikes. The rest had to come home because you can't find anybody. What's the strength of the Islamic State? Well, it's a mixture of religious fanaticism and military expertise drawn from long experience of fighting. But also, it has the support of a large chunk of the Sunni communities in Iraq and Syria. Because I have friends in Mosul, I talk to them, I mean, email them, you know, they're terrified of ISIS. And they're very terrifying people. But they're also terrified of the Iraqi government. In fact, they're even more terrified if you're a Sunni in Mosul, a city of about 2 million people, the second largest in Iraq, which was taken by the Islamic State on the 10th of June. You're terrified of them coming in, of taking the young men, torturing them into confessions, shooting them. You're terrified of all the women being raped. And these are very real fears. Even a few months ago, you went around Fallujah, west of Baghdad, the Sunni villages there. You can't find many of the young men, because they're all in jail. Some of them have confessed to crimes, capital crimes, for which they're going to be executed. Sometimes they're going to be executed for crimes that people have already been executed for, but the cash confessions are down there. So my point is this, that unless you can address what has happened to the Sunni community in Iraq, these poor people have no choice but to think we have to stick with the Islamic State. That's essentially a political problem there. And however much military support you give, let's say the Americans are sending in advisors and these forward air observers, these are quite useful military things. But at the end of the day, for maybe there are 5 or 6 million Sunni in Iraq, these people have no choice but to stick with the Islamic State unless there is an alternative, which the Iraqi government doesn't give them. The same is generally true in Syria. This is a genuine civil war. One can speak of the atrocities of the Syrian government, and they're very real, but it's a civil war that everybody has terrible atrocities, rather more on the government side because they have greater capacity to use violence. But I mean, earlier this year, I was in a village north of Damascus called Adra. This was just on the edge of it. This had been taken over by jihadis, not the Islamic State. They'd killed non-Sunni Muslims, some Alawite families, the same sect which the president belongs to, had thought they were going to be murdered, tortured, and so forth, had blown themselves up with grenades. These weren't fanatics. These were very sort of secular people who thought they had no choice. So it's a real civil war one would be intervening in. Now, what should one do in these circumstances? I mean, John Redwood made this point so eloquently. You need a political approach. You need to drain away war. The Islamic State became so powerful because of war. There was a sort of pretense that... In 2007, the Americans had 157,000 troops in Iraq. Al-Qaeda was much weaker than the Islamic State is. There was a sort of pretense by General Petraeus and the Bush administration that they destroyed al-Qaeda in Iraq. As we can see, they didn't, because it's now produced the Islamic State. Could those forces be mobilized again? No, they couldn't. So what one needs to do is reduce the level of violence. And in Syria, you do that by getting the non-ISIS Islamic State forces, Assad and his opponents, to have a ceasefire. These people hate each other, so they're not going to reach a political solution. Just a ceasefire. You need a truce. You need to reduce the level of violence so everybody isn't petrified in Iraq and Syria and rallies to the most extreme and effective of their communal leaders. Ed Hussein made some eloquent points, some good points, but the reality is about Saudi Arabia and the spread of Wahhabism, but the reality of this intervention, proposed intervention in Iraq and Syria, is we are doing it in alliance with Saudi Arabia and the Gulf monarchies that are the last theocratic absolute monarchies left on earth. So one of the things that has distorted and degraded the uprisings of the Arab Spring is that we gave support in Libya, but we were accompanied and we were aided by and got money from Saudi Arabia and Qatar and people who had no interest in democracy, the last thing they wanted in their own countries or anywhere else, were extreme Sunni and had a wholly sectarian agenda. We're now sort of doing the same thing again. We have the same array of allies standing with us against Assad and saying that they're going to train their own moderates. You can imagine what the Saudi monarchy's idea of a moderate is. In this situation, there is a limit to what can be done. You can have a degree of limited intervention, maybe some defending Erbil and so forth. But anything beyond that, you plug into a series of interrelated conflicts, which you will only exacerbate. You won't make them better. You will stir the pot. You will make war worse. You will get more people killed. And you will ensure that the Islamic State survives and flourishes. Because war is what it knows about and what it's good at. Thank you.
Patrick Coburn. And our third speaker tonight against the motion is Associate Director of the Henry Jackson Society in London and also Associate Editor of The Spectator magazine. Please welcome Douglas Murray.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you, Andrew. Thank all of you for coming out. I should start by mentioning, as some of you I may have seen last year when I was arguing against intervention in Syria, and I will explain for a second why that position is sustainable. I opposed intervention in Syria last year because it was perfectly clear to me that this country and our ally, the US, had no idea what we wanted from an intervention, other than, as John Kerry at one point put it, making a very meaningless gesture, sending a missile that would hit nothing. I thought that was an unwise policy, and I still think it is. It betrayed an appalling lack of strategy. But we are not arguing that tonight. Tonight's motion that Iraq and Syria are lost causes seems to me highly able to be debated. And the second part, that Western intervention cannot help, is, I think, a terrible thing for this House, for you, ladies and gentlemen, tonight to vote on. Let me first of all say, though, there have been points from our opponents tonight which I very much agree with. And the first of those points was Nabila's point when she said at the very outset that we fail, we in the West fail to understand the problem. I could not agree more. It is pitiful hearing politicians in Washington and London talking about this problem. They barely even want to discuss it. John Kerry last week, on Thursday last week, in the State Department, gave a speech about ISIS. He said three particularly notable things. He said that ISIS had nothing to do with Islam. I'm glad you laugh. It deserves a laugh. Secondly, he said that it is, however, among other things, caused by global warming. And secondly, he said, by the lack of a solution to the Israel-Palestine conflict, a view which ISIS doesn't particularly care about as it happens. But that is the same thing that you hear from our politicians here, a total inability to deal with what ISIS actually is and the problems that they raise. Now, there have been, having said that, I agree with that one thing said by the other side, I will mention a couple of the things that are highly able to be disagreed with. First of all, Nabila says intervention will cause more problems than it will solve, and says, and describes with a warning, she says, we have to be careful where intervention leads us. What interventions are we talking about? Sure, the world, the West in particular, is still deeply scarred from the new Western way of war as shown in Afghanistan and Iraq, which is to stay around for about a decade, change the reasons you're there, and then retreat at a draw at best. It's true, it's an embarrassment. It's an embarrassment. But to claim that that is intervention as a whole, I think, is a great mistake. We don't talk anymore about the successful ones. What about Sierra Leone? What about that? Almost nobody in this country even remembers it. What about Kosovo? What about the opportunity in Europe to stop the ethnic cleansing of Muslims in Europe? Very few people talk about it, but we do remember the bad ones. We do remember where it's gone wrong. Nabila also said, she said that the Middle East must change from within. Local people should defeat ISIS. Ladies and gentlemen, I point you to a single infographic if you'd like to look at this. The Washington Post 2 days ago did an amazing and important infographic of the attempt by local tribes to rise up against ISIS. It's a massacre on each of the occasions we're talking about. A massacre. 700 people there, 400 people there. If we think we can do absolutely nothing to change that, then this is a council of despair. But Nabila also said, and this is a crucial one, the resentment is widespread in the region. Now, I don't doubt that for a moment, but isn't it possible to try to turn that around? Isn't it possible, at least in a hall like this, to change that around? Nabila said the West has been bombing Iraq for decades. Not true. We haven't been bombing Iraq for decades. This country hasn't been bombing Iraq for decades. But would anyone like to just go back to first principles again and try to remember why we have tried to get involved in that region and what the purpose has been when we have? Has it been because this country is just delighted at dropping bombs from 20,000 feet or however many thousand feet John Redwood talked about and likes dropping bombs on Iraq? Of course not. The problem is that this country not only doesn't seem to know what we want from this region or from our affairs internationally, we also don't want to even argue for ourselves. Our own elected representatives misrepresent the reasons why we go into these countries. We don't do it for ourselves. We don't do it for BP, as the cheap lie goes. We did it in 2003 onwards because we thought, foolishly to many people's minds now, that it was worth trying to get a decent democracy going in Iraq. John Redwood said, why isn't Iraq a great democracy? One of the reasons is that we face an unbelievably potent and determined enemy in Iraq, as we do in many other places around the region, as we do elsewhere in the globe. And please save us the frigging Northern Ireland comparison. I mean, really, Northern Ireland, save me. I promise I can clear a room in 30 seconds chatting about Northern Ireland. I wrote a notably badly selling book about it. There is much of interest in Northern Ireland, but Northern Ireland is not ISIS. Our best hope for ISIS is not that we find the most bloodthirsty person from ISIS akin to the Martin McGuinness of the IRA and make him leader of the region. But, you know, this idea that that we're here, I want to just spend my last remaining minutes focusing on the real problem here. The problem for us in the West is always the same in this. We're damned if we do, we're damned if we don't. We're damned if we intervene, we're damned if we don't. You intervene in Kosovo, nobody says thank you, nobody says look, thank God or thank Allah for NATO. Nobody says it. You do intervene and nobody thanks you if it goes wrong. It doesn't matter. Nobody wants to thank us. So we do have to ask, what do we actually want? And I would suggest the following to you tonight. We need to decide in this country and our allies what our priorities are. There are a whole set at the moment going on and they are mutually contradictory. Are we defending borders? Are we advancing democracy? Are we protecting human rights? Are we trying to stop massacres wherever they happen? Are we trying to stop genocides across the region? Are we trying to stop nuclear proliferation? We are at the moment committed, it seems, to almost all of these policies, but it is like a great big game of kaplunk. You pull one of those straws out and it's highly likely that you're going to notice and knock against another and have a result. try to defeat ISIS, you'll need a bit of Iranian help, they will expect something back on the nuclear program and so on. So I would argue, for this country, we need to decide what our own priorities are before we ever think of committing. But that does not mean we should never commit. Now, Lord Dannett said we can't accept lost causes. I couldn't agree more. The whole post-9/11 thing was we would stop there being ungoverned spaces. Afghanistan was an ungoverned space, and the Al-Qaeda was able to train there, and they were able to attack New York and Washington. The aim was not to have ungoverned spaces. Look around the world now, and it is covered in ungoverned spaces. That is not a problem, ladies and gentlemen, that we are going to be able to walk away from. Because this is not just the problem for the region. It isn't just the problem for Iraq or Syria. It's a problem for us. If you doubt that, let me give you one fact I hope you could carry away with you this evening. There are more British Muslims who have gone out to fight for ISIS than there are British Muslims in the UK armed forces. That is a problem. And I would submit it's one that's going to be coming back to us soon. Mehdi Nemmouche, the young French citizen who went out to fight with ISIS and returned, what did he do when he returned? As it was in his case, he went to Belgium. In May this year, he went into the Jewish Museum in the capital there and gunned down three people. We're going to see lots more of that, ladies and gentlemen, and it's not a prediction I like to make. We have a real problem. We have a problem, I think if you've looked at your feeds tonight, you'll notice there's a problem in the Ottawa Parliament tonight where somebody's decided to start shooting at soldiers and politicians. This isn't just a problem we can wish away. We can't draw up the drawbridge anymore. It's not possible. This is really what globalization means. It means you have a problem in Syria, and it will involve us. It does involve us. Should we be intelligent about it? Of course. Should we intervene every time anyone asks us to? Of course not. We have to be intelligent, we need to be thoughtful about this, but we cannot accept the destruction and disintegration of borders, the massacring of peoples, the possible toppling of friendly powers across an entire region with British citizens as part of it and think that's not going to be our problem. It is our problem. That's the nature of things. We're not going to be thanked. A lot of people will point it out to us when we get things wrong, and so they should. But occasionally this country can also get things right. And if we can get something right here, ladies and gentlemen, I would suggest that this House doesn't vote against that. Thank you.
Douglas Murray.
Douglas Murray, bringing the end of our formal part of the debate. I'm now going to throw it open to you. I've come up here because I can keep a better eye on you from here. On the way in, you voted for the motion, 83, against the motion, 64, don't know, 139. I think that's what we call in the business all to play for both sides. Let me get some questions, please. We have microphones around. Gentlemen there, and let me get another one. Let me see. Can you spot someone? Where? Yep, microphone there. Yes, keep your comments or your questions short and direct them to a particular part of the panel.
Thank you. Nabila talked about using local forces to defeat ISIS, which, of course, has to be part of the solution. But she then went on to recommend that we rely on factions like Iran, which funds terrorist groups like Hezbollah and Hamas, and a genocidal dictator like Assad to do this. But replacing Sunni terrorists with Shia ones and empowering dictators like Assad and Khamenei will represent a strategic defeat for us and the people of the region. So why are we ignoring the Kurds, who are battle-hardened, many thousands strong, and the only nominally moderate and pro-Western faction in the region? Is it not time to meaningfully arm the outgunned Kurds who are valiantly battling these barbaric, well-armed killers and finally give them a fighting chance?
Okay, thank you for that. Nabila?
Well, that's a very good question. And as a matter of fact, we're not ignoring the Kurds. We, you know, the West is very much aware of the Kurds' formidable fighting capabilities. That's why we're helping them, and we're actively doing that. We're arming them, we're training them, we're advising them, and we're helping with, strikes as well. I presented my case by saying that I have no magical solution. There is certainly no quick fix to an extremely complicated regional problem, and my proposition was entirely pragmatic. Yes, working with devils like Assad and indeed Iran is a very difficult and tricky choice to make, but it's an entirely practical proposition to an extremely daunting problem which is growing in the region. And only Assad, as it stands, and Iran can and would provide plausible ground forces. Turkey can also be talked into doing that.
So why doesn't Assad attack now? What's stopping Assad from going on?
Well, as a matter of fact, they're waiting for the Americans' green light, and they're waiting for assurances that the Assad regime wouldn't be threatened in the wake of doing that. I think the Russians have a very important role to play in that too, in facilitating the negotiations and indeed talks between the Assad regime, Iran, and indeed the West in dealing with ISIS. Russia also have massive problems with brimming armed Muslims and sees a group like ISIS or their like as a threat to Russia. So Moscow could actually facilitate dealing with IS, not because Putin is kind-hearted, but because that group represents an obvious threat to him as well.
Can I just take, are we right, in your view, to be arming the Kurds?
I mean, you're asking a moral question there.
No, it's a practical question. Are we right to be arming the Kurds or not?
I think it's part of being practical about sorting out that problem, and as I've argued in my case, you have to be very careful about.
So Western intervention has a role.
You have to be careful about the how you deal with the Kurds and how you help them out.
Sure.
Because what you're effectively doing, and indeed encouraging by proxy, is the breakup of the sovereign state of Iraq as an entity.
Well, I'm not sure. Should we do it or shouldn't we do it then?
You have to be very careful about how you do it, but I think it's a plausible and credible solution in the meantime.
I think there's one key problem that's missing there. It is undoubtedly right to arm, equip and train and help the Peshmerga, the Kurds, defend their own territory, defend their own citizens, defend their own families. That's only a decent thing to do. But I'm afraid that's not going to result in the destruction and the defeat of Islamic State.
Quite.
There has got to be some form of offensive operation against them. Defending your territory is one thing, but actually going forward is another. And that's where the question has to come, is there enough capability in the region to do that? That's an open question, which is why we
what's
may
the answer?
Have
is
to
there enough capability in the region?
You asking me?
That's my job.
Well, as I hinted in my main address, I don't believe that there is. I think we need to spend a period of time building up that local capability, arming, equipping and training, and it would be best if they can deal with it themselves. But if they cannot, and if we accept that ISIL and Islamic State is unacceptable and its influence is going to spread in a malign way beyond the region, then we may have to come at the end of the day to realise that actually they're going to need Western support in order to do what's got to be done.
But you heard what Patrick Coburn had to say about the state of the Iraqi army. What was it? 200,000 to be a general? That didn't cost you 200,000 to be a general.
No, I'm still working on it. But I think
taxpayers paid for that. 2 million to be a divisional commander? How can you fight a war with an army constructed like that?
Patrick's description was part of the description. The other part of the description was actually a lot of these people were Shia placemen as a result of the malign Maliki influence. Probably quite a number of those soldiers probably would have fought reasonably, but their leadership was appalling. The leadership fled, and the soldiers, frankly, they fled as well.
Patrick, is there any sign that the Iraqi army could become, in the foreseeable future, a credible fighting force?
No, I don't think so, because it's really... I mean, I asked an Iraqi politician last year, who I didn't quite believe in. He told me the Iraqi army won't fight. And I said, well, some of these officers will fight. And he said, well, no, Patrick, you got it wrong. These aren't soldiers, they're investors. They paid a lot of money for these jobs. They're not planning to fight anybody.
All right, now, let's see another question, please. Who's got the microphone? Yes, who's got the microphone? Well, stand up and give us a question. It'd be help if you stand up, we'll hear you better.
Can you hear me now?
Certainly can.
This is another question for the panellists who are for the motion. If we take it as a given that as long as ISIS can gain territory, it will, is there anywhere, any point at which you would intervene? And if so, where would it be? Would it be Bulgaria? Would it be Bosnia? Would it be at the gates of Vienna? And the only other point I would make is please don't say this is a hypothetical question because it is a real threat.
All right. John Redwood.
Well, no, it's a silly question. This is...
Why
20,000 or 30,000 people who, at most, who are a very mixed band. Some are really evil and unpleasant, so we all feel the pain of watching these awful videos. But there is no nice way to murder people, and ISIL don't have a monopoly on murdering people in this area. There are all sorts of other groups murder people and take to the streets as armed bands. And there is no way that they're going to challenge the Turkish state, which is the northern buffer of this particular civil war. So I don't buy this line that we need to immediately put a massive field army out there, otherwise the next thing is it will be across the channel trying to float a flotilla of boats to come to London.
But would it matter if they took Baghdad?
Well, it would matter to some of the people in Baghdad a great deal, yes. But my case...
No, what I mean is, would it matter for the geopolitics of the region and for the West if they took Baghdad?
I don't think it's a good development, but I don't particularly like the people who say they're in control of Baghdad at the moment. This is my point, that this is a serious regional and local conflict with a religious civil war, armed bands, tribal violence, a complete breakdown in civil order. Injecting Western violence into this situation cannot conceivably solve it. We know that because we've tried this endlessly in the Middle East in recent years, and we're now talking about something that people say is even worse than before we began all these interventions. And I must take issue with this argument that you can learn nothing from a situation like Northern Ireland. Of course you can. There was serious violence, but we didn't allow it to become a complete breakdown in the state. And then when we rediscovered the skills of politics, we started to make the position better. Now, I do not know who can emerge in these countries to do that kind of process, but what I can tell you is that it won't be peace in those countries until people do emerge and who can do that. And I and my colleagues can't inject a few thousand troops from the United Kingdom or some bombs from planes operating on 700-mile round trips trying to find targets and hope to create a successful, flourishing democracy in Iraq and Syria. It is not feasible.
Okay, I know you're all bursting to speak here, but I want to get some more questions. The gentleman in a white shirt and the gentleman at the back there. Keep your hand up, sir. We'll get a mic to you. Yep, you.
Yes, sir. Just a quick question on Turkey. Turkey would not want to see an independent Kurdistan, and it would oppose that. What does the panel have a view on that?
You name somebody in the panel. We can't have all six. We'll be here all night.
Lord Dannett.
Absolutely right. Turkey does not want to see an independent Kurdistan. The problem is the Kurdish people exist. They are a nation. They happen to be spread amongst Syria, Iraq, and Turkey. It's a real problem for them, and that struggle is not going to be very easily resolved. Yes, Turkey does not want to see an independent Kurdistan. The Kurdish nation does. That's going to go on for some time. Palestinians the same.
But what does that mean in terms of the Western response? Because we know, we've seen Turkey recently taking it out on the PKK, at a time when they're already under threat from IS.
Well, let's try and take these things three at a time, as opposed to 25 at a time. The problem that's confronting us at the present moment is the appalling Islamic State and ISIL regime in Iraq and Syria. That's what's got to be destroyed first and foremost. Other issues like Kurdistan, a Kurdish nation, other issues like what to do with Assad, they're going to come later. But let's deal with what's in front of us at the present moment, because that's a really dangerous one. That's what's got to be gripped first.
Gentleman with the microphone up there.
This is a question from Mr. Redwood. You say we can learn something from Northern Ireland. Can we learn anything from Kosovo and Bosnia where intervention did help? Should we be aiming for a Dayton Accord where the West could provide perhaps political leadership, some military intervention to try and bring about the least worst solution, which may be a breakup of Iraq and Syria?
John Redwood.
I don't think we have the skills to do that. Yes, of course you can learn from all these situations, but I think it's easier for the regional powers to try and do this. And if the regional powers don't buy in to any realignment of the borders, if that is what is needed, it can't conceivably work. We have sold enormous quantities of weapons to the major powers in the Middle East. They've got quite enough arms to fight any kind of war they want. I think it would be better if the great regional powers of the Middle East actually wanted to talk to each other. Because it may require some change of the borders, or it may certainly require a change of approach towards their religious differences and their tribal differences if we are going to get peace. That is not something that the United Kingdom can impose on them or can even lead. I don't think they're ready yet for this kind of process. But I would far rather that my country wanted to lead the diplomatic and negotiating process if they wished us to do so, than thought that a little bit of bombing and maybe a few troops could conceivably make a positive difference. We're kidding ourselves if we think it can.
Can I just ask you, because you also said in your remarks that you wanted to leave it to the regional powers, leave it to local forces. You mentioned Iran, you mentioned Syria. But if you do that, is it not the case that since we're dealing with essentially a Sunni-Shia civil war in this region, that the regional powers will simply take sides in the civil war and use these forces as their proxies? Isn't that what's going to happen? So you just exacerbate the civil war with the Iranians, the Saudis, Syria, and others.
But that is what is happening. That is what is happening, but the question is, when are they going to want something better to happen?
Let me hear from
Nabila, then I'll come to you. Nabila.
And you can also take advantage of those conflicts between different interest groups to make the situation better. For example, I was talking about how Iran could be used to, help defeat IS because they have an interest in protecting Shiite capitals like Tehran, Damascus, in the region.
Well, why hasn't Iran done that already? What's stopping it?
Because effectively, countries like Syria or indeed Iran are waiting for the green lights from America. They have set
why
a coalition
a
of the willing, which involve the closest allies like Saudi Arabia.
Why do they need a green light from America?
I'm telling you, because the coalition of the willing, as it stands, involves countries like Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Qatar, which are close allies to America and who resent. They are Sunni countries who resent the role
but
of
the Iran and Syria are not close allies of America. Why do they need a green light?
Sorry, could you say that again?
Well, you said that Iran and Syria were waiting on a green light from America before they did anything, and I'm trying to work out why do these two countries, who are not exactly best friends of America, need a green light from Washington?
Because Assad, for example, he needs quiet assurances from America that his regime is not going to be threatened and that a Western intervention to deal with IS is not going to be an excuse to bring the end to his own regime.
All right. Let me see some... Yes, gentleman there. Can we get a microphone? And do you want? And the lady there, if you keep your hand up. Yes.
I knew you were ex-military when he said he didn't want a microphone.
How practically can you fight an enemy that doesn't wear uniform? And also, as soon as things aren't going their way, they just melt into the background.
Exactly.
Okay. Thank you. General Danner?
Well, the short answer, actually, is that it's extraordinarily difficult. However, ISIL has chosen to occupy territory. And by doing that, it makes itself a defined target, and therefore it's possible to plan offensive operations against it. If it was a classic insurgency, when the people were on one side or another and the insurgents were operating amongst them, very, very difficult.
But
they're choosing to hold towns, they're choosing to hold villages. That means that they become vulnerable and they can be attacked.
Isn't that the point that ISIS is a transnationalist organisation? It doesn't believe in nationalism. It's anti-nationalism and therefore has no boundaries. It wants to have... A caliphate, the world, it has a global view.
All the more reason to destroy it now while it's contained in a small landmass rather than allow it to expand further and then say, we knew there were transnationalists in this manifest.
I think also it points to the illogicality of the vote in Parliament 3 or 4 weeks ago to just bomb in Iraqi airspace and not deal with the whole problem as opposed to just half the problem.
We'll
be back at that one quite soon.
It may be right or it may be wrong as a policy. But in practical politics, do you believe there is a shred of public support for the British to get involved in a guerrilla war in Iraq/Syria?
At this precise moment in time, very little.
Can you envisage circumstances where there ever would be?
Right. I can't predict the future. If you could predict the future, you'd be a very rich person. But what I think we do know is that ISIL and Islamic State, as it currently stands, is despicable and must be dealt with. If it can't be dealt with by
that's
any,
not a policy.
If
that's
it can't
ju-
be dealt with
proposition.
Any other way, it may have... Well, it is a policy, because actually you've stated your objective, which actually is the defeat and destruction of Islamic State and ISIL, and therefore you've got to do whatever you can to achieve that.
Yes, lady over there.
A question for Ed Hussein. When you visit displaced populations and refugee camps, do you sense that there are people who are willing to go back and fight for their territory? People of whom the case for living in peace and for democracy and for pluralism has already been made.
Okay, thank you for that. Ed Hussein.
Yes, in Gaziantep, where in Turkey there's a huge building, interestingly called, it's painted in white on the outside and it's a huge house, and therefore with Syrian humour they call it the White House, which is the headquarters of what's called the Syrian Interim Government, the SIG. And there are thousands of people coming and going who on a regular basis want to do exactly that, go back to their country and help build an alternative government. And as it stands, they do control large parts of territory inside Syria, but also the education system that's rolled out inside the refugee camps. So in the short answer is yes, there is a willingness for people in the SIG and others to go back and to replace the Assad government. But that's not to say it's going to be all hunky-dory, so to speak. They realize it's going to be a tough second stage of the civil war, where there will be different groups fighting one another, and all the more reason, therefore, to invest in them now, identify the right people, and ensure that they're stronger when they go back, so they're not fighting ISIS or future variations of it that are already not only battle-hardened, but have government experience.
All right, let me have some more questions, please. Yes, the lady there, we get a microphone, and then you can pass it to the gentleman. Let me see over this side. Yes, a gentleman there. Keep your hand up, and then we'll get some more at the back. Yes.
Hi, sorry, this won't be very eloquent. My school assembly didn't look quite the way this room did. I'd just like to ask that the board all has similar ethics and morals and all the things that they want to achieve from peace and harmony. But historically, change takes a lot of time.
I need a question.
Tens or hundreds of years.
I need a question.
Historically, tens or hundreds of years. Why do we think that the slaughter of potentially millions of people can take place over such a small period of history right now?
Who would you like to answer that question?
Ed Hussein.
Good luck, Ed.
With all respect, I don't think the proposition is to kill millions of people, nor do I think it's to kill them over a short period of time. But you're absolutely right that change does take significant periods of time, and the Arab world has been in that period of trying to bring about change. And I'll say this, you know, to answer this question very quickly, that there is a battle of ideas going on in the Arab world, and that battle of ideas has unfolded since the 1850s. So, yes, change takes time, and we're almost 200 years into that battle of ideas. So I think it's right for us to expect that in the next century or so we should see a closure of that battle of ideas.
But I wasn't quite clear from your speech if in this battle of ideas, are the Saudis on the good side or the bad side?
You were confused about whether the Saudis were on the good side?
Well,
what I said.
Well, because at the moment the Saudis... I'm not worried about I mean, you seem to say that the Saudis were kind of, really, that's where IS comes from. That's the origins of it, because of the Wahhabism. On the other hand, the Saudis are now really worried about IS.
Because IS has them in its target.
So are they on our side or on their side?
They are on both sides.
So you want us to get involved in a civil war where Saudi Arabia is on both sides?
For the short term, we will use Saudi air bases, but in the long term, we're fully aware that the sympathies of many in their population and many in their government are essentially with the ISIS worldview. We can't be naive about the nature of the enemy.
All right. Good luck with that. Who's got the microphone now? Gentleman over there. And then I'll come back to you, sir. Yes.
Thank you very much. My name is Tony Kitsumbos, Chairman of Debate in London. My question is to John Redwood. And this is in reference to your argument that a political solution is preferable to a military one. Speaking in Chatham House yesterday, the president of Rwanda, Paul Kagame, said, that the problem with international action is that it is better at containing problems than solving them. And he should certainly know, based on the experience of Rwanda, which, of course, 20 years ago had its genocide of 1 million
people. I need a question too, please.
The question is this. Now, they are an example of a political solution being locally developed, solving the endemic causes of the